Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information and issues. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we always look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. In an article about student loans from Ron Lieber of the New York Times, placing the blame as students are buried in debt. Like many middle-class families, Courtney Muna and her mother began the college selection process with a grim determination. They would do whatever they could to get Courtney into the best possible college, and they maintained a blind faith that the investment would be worth it. Today, however, Ms. Muna, a 26-year-old graduate of New York University, has nearly $100,000 in student loan debt from her 4 years in college, and affording the full monthly payments would be a struggle. So much of the time since her 2005 graduation, she's enrolled in night school, which allows her to defer loan payments. This is not a long-term solution, because the interest on the loans continues to pile up. So, in an eerie echo of the mortgage crisis, tens of thousands of people like Ms. Muna are facing a reckoning. They and their families made borrowing decisions based more on emotion than reason, much as subprime borrowers assume the value of their houses would always go up. Meanwhile, universities like NYU enrolled students without asking many questions about whether they could afford a $50,000 a year annual tuition bill. Then the colleges introduced the students to lenders who underwrote big loans without any idea of what the students might earn someday, which is just like the mortgage lenders who didn't ask borrowers to verify their incomes. Ms. Muna does not want to walk away from her loans in the same way many mortgage holders are. It would be difficult in any event because federal bankruptcy law makes it nearly impossible to discharge student loan debts. But unless she manages to improve her income quickly, she doesn't have a lot of good options for digging out. It is utterly depressing that there are so many people like her facing decades of payments, a limited capacity to buy a home, and a debt burden that can repel potential life partners. For starters, it's a shared failure of parenting and loan underwriting. But perhaps the biggest share lies with colleges and universities because they have the most knowledge of the financial aid process. And I would argue that they had an obligation to counsel students like Ms. Muna, who got in too far over their heads. How many people are like her? According to the College Board's Trends in Student Aid study, 10% of people who graduated in 2007 and 2008 with student loans had borrowed $40,000 or more. The median debt for bachelor's degree recipients who borrowed while attending private nonprofit colleges was $22,380. The Project on Student Debt, a research and advocacy organization in Oakland, California, used federal data to estimate that 206,000 people graduated from college, including many from for-profit universities, with more than $40,000 in student loan debt in the same period. That's a nine-fold increase over the number of people in 1996 using 2008 dollars. No one forces borrowers to take out these loans, and Ms. Muna and her mother, Catherine, have spent the years since her graduation trying to understand where they went wrong. Ms. Muna's father died when she was 13 after a series of illnesses. She started college at age 17 and borrowed as much money as she could under the federal loan program to make up the difference between her grants and work-study money and the total cost of attending. Her mother co-signed two private loans with Sallie Mae, totaling about $20,000. When they applied for a third loan, however, Sallie Mae rejected the application, citing Catherine's credit history. She had returned to college herself to finish her bachelor's degree and was also borrowing money. NYU suggested a Federal Plus loan for parents, but that would have required immediate payments, something the mother couldn't afford. So before Courtney's junior year, NYU recommended that she apply for a private loan on her own with Citibank. Over the course of the next 2 years, starting when she was still a teenager, she borrowed about $40,000 from Citibank without thinking much about how she would pay it back. How could her mother have let her run up that debt? And why didn't she try to make her daughter transfer to, say, the best school in the much cheaper state university system in New York? All I could see was college, and a good college, and how proud I was of her, Catherine said. All we needed to do was get this education and the good job. This is the thing that eats away at me, the naivete on my part. But Courtney resists the idea that this is a tale of bad parenting. To me, it would be an uncharitable reading, she said. My mother has tried her best, and I don't blame her for anything in this. Sallie Mae gets a pass here, in my view. A responsible grown-up co-signed for its loans to the Munas, and the company eventually cut them off. But what was Citibank thinking? Handing over $40,000 to an undergraduate who had already amassed debt well into the five figures. That was, in effect, a no-doc, or at least a low-doc, subprime mortgage loan. A city spokesman declined to comment, even though Ms. Muna was willing to sign a waiver giving city permission to talk about her loans. Perhaps the bank worried that once it approved one loan, cutting her off would have led her to drop out or transfer and have trouble paying back the loan. Today, someone like Ms. Muna might not qualify for the $40,000 she borrowed. But as the economy rebounds, there is little doubt that plenty of lenders will step forward to roll the dice on desperate students, especially because the students generally can't get rid of the debt in bankruptcy court. So who's to blame for assigning high student loan debt? What about the university? The financial aid office has the best picture of what students like Ms. Muna are up against because they see their family's financial situation splayed out on the federal financial aid form. So why didn't NYU tell Ms. Muna that she simply did not belong there once she passed, say, $60,000 in total debt? Had somebody called me and said, "Do you have a clue where this is all headed?" It would have been a slap in the face, but a slap in the face that I needed, said Catherine Muna. When financial aid told her that they could get her $2,000 more in loans, they should have been saying, "You are in deep doo-doo, little girl." That's not a role that the university wants to take on, though. I think that would be completely inappropriate, said Daniel Dyke, the vice president of enrollment management for NYU, who oversees admissions and financial aid. Some families will do whatever it takes for their son or daughter to be not just at NYU, but any first choice college. I'm not sure that's always the best decision, but it's one that they really have to make themselves. The complications here go well beyond the propriety of suggesting that a student enroll elsewhere. Colleges don't always know how much debt its students are taking on, which makes it hard to offer good counsel. NYU does appear to have known about all of Ms. Muna's loans, though. Then there's a branding problem. Urging students to attend a cheaper college or leave altogether suggests a lack of confidence about the earning potential of alumni. Nobody wants to admit that. And once a university starts encouraging middle-class students to go elsewhere, it must fill its classes with children of the wealthy and a much smaller number of low-income students to whom it can afford to offer enormous scholarships. That's hardly an ideal outcome either. Finally, universities exist to enroll students, not turn them away. Eight administrators want to keep their jobs, said Joan Chrisman, interim president and chief executive of the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators. If the administration finds out that you're encouraging students to go to a cheaper school just because you don't think they can handle the debt load, I don't think that's going to mesh very well. That doesn't change the fact, however, that the financial aid office is still in the best position to see trouble coming and do something to stop it. University officials should take on this obligation, even if they aren't willing to advise students to attend another college. Instead, they might deputize a gang of MBA candidates or alumni in financial services industry to offer free financial planning to admitted students and their families. Mr. Dyke also noted that the bigger problem here is one of financial literacy. Fine. He and NYU are in a great position to solve that by making every financial aid recipient take a financial planning class. The students could even use their families as the case study. The balance on Courtney Muna's loans is about $97,000, including all of her federal loans and her private debt from Sallie Mae and Citibank. What are her options for digging out? Her mother can't help without selling her bed and breakfast, and then she'd have no home. She could take her daughter in, but there aren't good ways for her to earn a living in Alexandria Bay in upstate New York. Courtney could move someplace cheaper than her current home city of San Francisco, but she worries about her job prospect, even with her NYU diploma. She recently received a raise and now makes about $22 an hour working for a photographer. It's the highest salary she's earned since graduating with an interdisciplinary degree in religious and women's studies. After taxes, she takes home about $2,300 a month. Rent runs $750, and the full monthly payment on her student loans would be about $700 if they weren't being deferred, which would not leave a lot left over. She may finally be earning enough to barely scrape by while still making the payments for the first time since she graduated, at least until interest rates rise and the payments on her loans with variable rates spiral up. And while her job requires her to work nights and weekends sometimes, she probably should find a flexible second job to try to bring in a few extra $100 a month. Ms. Muna understands this tough love, buck up, buckle down advice. But she also badly wants to call a do-over on the last decade. I don't want to spend the rest of my life slaving away to pay for an education I got for 4 years, and I would happily give back, she said. It feels wrong to me. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. For some time now, we have been discussing the two-income trap, why middle-class parents are going broke by Professor Elizabeth Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi. And even though we're not finished with this discussion, today I want to depart from the continuation of it to discuss a current analysis of the economy and its impact on consumer debtors, which is essentially the thoughts of a premier consumer bankruptcy attorney, O. Max Gardner III, from North Carolina. This is something he wrote for his blog, and it's called The Great Unwind and the Final Redemption. And it has very important points for us to reflect on, consider, and possibly even act on if we are feeling any kind of strain with respect to our debt. So from Max, he says, what we are experiencing is called the global credit crisis for a reason. There is too much debt in the world. There is too much oil in the Gulf of Mexico and too little oil in the rest of the world. What used to be up now seems to be down. The stock market is going up on Monday and dropping more than 1,000 points Tuesday afternoon. The economy is in a, quote, recovery mode, end quote. But the unemployment numbers keep going up and up and up. What's wrong with these pictures? More and more economists are talking about the threat of a deflationary crisis ahead. Some are discussing hyperinflation. Others refer to a double-dip recession. A few even predict another depression. What we know for sure is that Greece, Italy, and Spain are broke. The euro has lost more value than the latest big fish just lost in Vegas. Foreclosures are at a historic high, and unemployment keeps going up. So what does this mean for you? Well, if you have a house that is underwater or more debt than you can reasonably hope to repay, your best options may be the unthinkable, as in filing for personal bankruptcy. But it really should not be unthinkable to default on a loan or even to declare bankruptcy. Don't stop listening. It is really a good option for many. It is moral, legal, and good for the country. It also has become very common. Mr. Gardner says you and your children will look back in a generation with pride. He goes on, in small amounts, debt is good. Home ownership is only possible for the young with mortgages, and many college degrees seem to be totally supported with student loans, which we just talked about at the beginning of the show here. Working capital for growing businesses allow for inventory and distribution expenses. Lenders benefit as well. High interest rates are paid to pensioners on their life savings. When debt exceeds a certain level, it becomes a cancer on society. Easy credit fuels speculation, which triggers bubbles. These bubbles lead to a temporary lift in apparent wealth, which increases economic activity beyond its sustainable level. But eventually, more and more debt triggers economic decline, with the inevitable glut of goods produced by an overheated economy. What people are discovering too late is that their debt is not repayable. Not now, not in the future, not ever. They once had a hope that they could wait out their bad times. This is true of many homeowners, many businesses, and many governmental bodies. The great unwind is now upon us and is picking up reverse speed every day. And the unwind is going to be deflationary. Prices and salaries will decline, jobs will become more scarce, and debt will continue to increase. According to Mr. Gardner, the earlier you pull the ripcord, the better off you will be later. In many states, mortgage loans are non-recourse debts. This means that the homeowner has no personal liability for the debt after foreclosure. In Iowa, as an aside, this is not the case. However, in most home foreclosures, the bank waives the deficiency for reasons that accelerate and protect getting the home back after the default. So what Mr. Gardner suggests is that when you are in this kind of circumstance and the debt is becoming overwhelming, never make another mortgage payment in those states, although, as I said, this is not a guarantee in Iowa. And those states are non-recourse debt states where there's no personal liability for the debt after the foreclosure. He says, turn over the keys after foreclosure. You will lose all of your down payment,
but
the lender can never get another penny from you. Your credit score will fall, but you do not want any more credit, right? If you are trying to quit crack, how would you feel about your pusher reducing your crack score? Does that make sense? If you plan to fight the war on drugs, you fight to win, right? Stay off credit for a few years, and they will take you back with open arms. Just be sure to look before you leap back into the credit patch in the future. So he continues on with a very profound point. There should no longer be any moral question about whether it is wrong to walk away from debt legally. The advent of limited liability corporations and the legal personhood of corporate shells have allowed business to create one-sided bets for years, and they happily walk away from corporate debt when the tide shifts. We all know this, we've seen it, and it's been in the media for quite a while. Donald Trump, the famed Donald, surely knows how to play this game. The Donald is a credit gamer. Whatever you say about Trump, the guy is a real player at and in the debt cancellation game. This could even be the basis for a new show, The Bankrupt. But the curious thing is that Trump is not the exception to the rule, and I'll continue in a moment. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So let's continue with Max Gardner's analysis. We're talking about Trump and the debt cancellation game, obviously big corporations. And we said Trump is not the exception to the rule, however. The Trumpum tactics are the calculus of the 21st century finance, and you are a bit player in the game. The big players are General Motors, Chrysler, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, Washington Mutual, and Countrywide. And if you read the papers or keep abreast of the media reports, we know what's going on with them. They have either eliminated their heavy debt loads by bankruptcies or by forced liquidations and mergers with the FDIC picking up the financial pieces. And even the Great Mortgage Bankers Association of America recently accepted a $40 million short sale and walked away from its former world headquarters on K Street in Washington, along with about $45 million in unpaid debt. So if you want to talk about moral hazards, then these are the players to talk about. Forget about John and Mary Smith on Main Street. John and Mary are mere pebbles in the sand on a very large beach. Nobody notices John and Mary, and from Max's point of view, nobody in Washington really cares. The current administration is implementing a policy of recapitalizing the banks, whose assets are still worth far less than their own debts, by lending them money through the Fed for nothing and borrowing back the money through the Treasury for a lot more. This is called transferring debt from the banks to the government. But government debt has the same drag on societies in the long run. They can just hold their breath longer, we hope. And the so-called HAMP program for mortgage modification is nothing more than a smoke and mirrors game designed to make us think that something is being done, when in fact nothing is happening other than secretly extending the day of the final reckoning. In short, there is no value in the net present value test of HAMP, period. According to Mr. Gardner, the longer this process takes, the more damage occurs to the society. And this process, in his view, is the true moral hazard of America. The hazard of not legally and effectively dealing with mountains of consumer debt. There are strange incentives that a person has when their debt is unpayable. Just think about it. Why would you try to earn more? The more you earn, the more debt you pay. But you can never earn enough to get out of debt. So Max says, stop trying. If you owe too much on your house, you might decide you have nothing more to lose on your house, so you simply decide to wait it out. What people do is they minimize the repairs and improvements on the house, rent the house out to frat boys, and hope for the best. You might as well best your nest eggs on winning the Powerball next week. The odds are not in your favor. The wait it out strategy will only prolong the financial and emotional agony. The banks are great examples of distorted incentives. They have sucked up well over $3 trillion of government money, yet they are still paying huge bonuses. They are not lending to businesses in need. They are not lending to consumers. They have raised their consumer credit standards, and they have not changed any of their prior internal standards. Distorted incentives indeed. So what Max says is, in the ancient days of Christian nations, you would have a debt jubilee every 30 years. So that's probably interesting for those of you who don't know this. It sounds like a party because it was. Debts were forgiven en masse when societies became constipated with debt. Also in the days of the Old Testament, individual debts were discharged once every 7 years. It was also considered a sin to try and collect debts after this 7-year discharge. As an aside, again, the Chapter 7 bankruptcy was named after this Old Testament directive. So in his final analysis, Max says, "Suffice it to say, we are currently a nation of many, many sinners, the vast majority of whom are trying to collect debts owed by the consumers, however. The only way to run these money changers out of the temple and to secure true redemption is to declare personal bankruptcy. You need to legally purge yourself of your debts and your houses and your expensive cars and start working for yourselves and for your family." He ends on a comical note, "Praise the Lord and pass around those bankruptcy petitions, like now, like yesterday." So that's from old Max Gardner III, replete with his personal knowledge and his opinions, and truly the basis for some deep personal thought on your financial circumstances, to wit, the great unwind and the final redemption. And finally, as reported in the businessinsider.com, a variety of positive economic data has been reported in recent months. Retail sales rose 0.4% in April 2010 as consumer spending rose and the U.S. gross domestic product grew at a rate of 3%. In May 2010, home sales rose to a five-month high and consumer confidence rose 17% from 57.7 to 63.3%. Industrial production rose 0.8% and durable goods orders rose 2.9%, which is more than had been forecast. However, the modest gains reported represent the continuing adaptation of economic activity at dramatically lower levels compared to the pre-recession period. And most of the reported gains have been substantially manufactured by massive government deficit spending. One of the most famous quotations of Austrian economist Ludwig von Mises is that, quote, "There is no means of avoiding the final collapse of a boom brought about by credit expansion. The alternative is only whether the crisis should come sooner as the result of a voluntary abandonment of further credit expansion, or later as a final and total catastrophe of the currency involved," end quote. In fact, the U.S. economy is in a downward spiral of debt deflation despite the bold actions of the federal government and the U.S. Federal Reserve taken in response to the financial crisis that began in 2008 and the associated recession. Although the vicious cycle of debt deflation is not widely recognized, precisely what Van Mises described is happening before our eyes, which is the crux of the issue right now and has led to the thinking of such analysts such as Max Gardner. And next week we'll get back to the two income trap and look at more things we can do to help ourselves. And remember, you can always go to the archives at www.kruufm.com, the section on life and debt, and you can listen to all the shows that have been produced on debt-related topics. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt-manageable life.